bring the Judiciary Committee meeting to order today, the Wednesday, the 27th of March. Today, on the schedule is going to be Senate Joint Resolution Number 9, House Bill 24, and Senate Bill 36. And I'm going to switch the order around a little bit, but just for the committee members' information and for those watching, Senate Bill 72, which is the Ombudsman's Bill, I'm just going to lay it aside today. I'm not going to deal with it today. So there won't be any discussion on it. So if there's anybody in the room or online that joined us with regard to the Ombudsman, we won't be dealing with that today. House Joint Resolution Number 4 is going to be held over. There's still some discussion. And then House Bill 69, if anybody's called in or anybody's online, House Bill 69, I'm still looking for an Attorney General opinion. I think I'm having an argument with the Attorney General on a couple of pieces of language there. And that's the issue of whether or not we can charge a federal government as a criminal for the Second Amendment issues in Alaska. So that's I'm trying to find a better piece of language, and I've been working on it. I'm on my third iteration. Friday, you'll see what I think is the best iteration. So with that, I have Senate Joint Resolution 9, which we've been talking about in committee, which is a constitutional amendment for education funding. Senator Dunleavy, why don't you come on up here for a second. My intention today is to bring this up for a vote today. We've had quite a bit of discussion. We've had a lot of public testimony. I will let it wander out into the educational discussion pretty significantly, to find out where it might go, because there's a lot of big what ifs if this should come up to the public for discussion. So Senator Dunleavy, any closing remarks at this point?
Thank you. Through the chair, we've had a couple committee meetings of testimony. You've heard from constitutional scholars across the from down to lower 48. You've heard testimony from in-state. You've heard testimony from folks that are pro or con. Again, I would just you saw a poll that was done recently by the House that indicates that folks in Alaska wouldn't mind having an opportunity to vote on their constitution. And again, I'll just bring it down to that. This is by moving this bill to the next committee, you give a chance to the next committee to hear it, and hopefully if it gets through the Senate, through the House, you're really just asking the folks of Alaska, what do they want to do with their constitution in terms of educational funding? And I've discussed what my intent and my reasons behind this are. I also mentioned, I think, at the last meeting that the issue of vouchers, it seems to have clouded the whole concept. And I did introduce a bill today on tax credits that would deal with that issue. In the last meeting, I spoke about how entities and movements across Lower 48 are dealing with, quote, vouchers through tax credits as opposed through a vehicle such as SJR-9, which would have some, I think it would have some significant issues if there was an attempt to do that, to fund religious and private schools through the public coffer. So we've got a bill on tax credits. We have SJR-9, and the idea would be, once again, that folks get a chance to vote on it. Folks can either say yes or no if they want to change their constitution. I'm prepared to answer any additional questions.
Is there any questions for the sponsor, Bill? Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Senator Dunleavy, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding from the testimony I've heard and the documents I've read, that many states that have the identical language we have in our Constitution, their courts have found that it is constitutional for public money to follow the student to the schools of their choice.
It, you know, some would say that Florida said no in a vote, but yesterday I believe it was Indiana's court ruled in favor of the concept of using public monies for, quote, vouchers to follow the kid to the child to private or sectarian or religious schools. So the issue that folks, I'll be very brief, but the issue that folks see with our situation is, although our language does not even include the concept of indirect, which is part of a standard Blaine amendment, constitutions such as Indiana and a couple weeks ago, even in Colorado, which has a much more restrictive and descriptive language regarding what you cannot do with public monies. In both of those cases, the courts found in favor of, quote, a voucher system. But again, for myself and others, this will allow us to expand the public education system and hopefully help more and more families and kids.
Yeah, my question was pretty narrow. So states with language like ours or even more restrictive, other courts have found that it's legitimate for the public money to follow the student.
That's what the courts are saying.
And then our problem is that a previous court decision in our state said no. And so our only choices are is to drum up another case that would wind its way through the courts, hoping that a more informed court would find differently. But we are what you're doing here is rather than doing that laborious process is clarifying our language to give us the flexibility to do things that probably you think and I think should be legitimate already.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think there's we've answered a lot of the judicial questions or had discussions. There are many more financial questions that have been discussed here. This bill goes on to the Finance Committee for those discussions. I think certainly it's been expressed here on this committee that no member that I've heard wants to see the public school system in Alaska fail. In fact, the bill's sponsor has made it very clear it's his intention to see it succeed.
Yes.
And to expand and to see Alaskan children and their families prosper. I'd like to make a motion that Senate Joint Resolution Number 9 move out of the Judiciary Committee and onto the Senate Finance Committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Any objection to moving it on forward? All right. We're going to move Senate Joint Resolution Number 9 then to the next committee referral, which is the Finance Committee.
Thank you
very much. Very much. Thank you, committee members. And why don't we take a brief at ease while we sign this up? All right, come back on record. Today we're going to have sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 36 brought before us. Senator Ellis is the prime sponsor, and Senator Ellis, why don't you go ahead and introduce this bill to us, and if any questions, we'll bring them up at this point.
Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis. I represent downtown and Mountain View in the Alaska State Senate, and as you said, I'm the sponsor of the legislation before you today, and thank you for having it up before the committee. I know you're busy. First and foremost, I'd like to thank Senator Dyson for joining me as a co-sponsor in this effort. A similar version of this bill, as you may know, passed the Senate 20-0 last year, and as you can see, like that bill, this bill has a zero fiscal note. So it's got a lot going for it. The only criticism I've heard, Mr. Chairman, along the way is why in the heck haven't we done this sooner? Alaska has a growing senior population, and we're one of the last states to get our act together in this regard. Not because of any bad intentions or anything like that, but just we just haven't mustered the will to yet do this, and I hope we will this year. This bill would simply ensure that our Department of Military and Veterans Affairs works together with the Department of Public Safety to develop plans for local and state law enforcement to quickly notify the media, the public, and other law enforcement agencies when a vulnerable adult goes missing. A Silver Alert program would establish clear and consistent lines of communication and develop efficient procedures for citizens, law enforcement, and media outlets to follow in this situation. This preparation will ensure we maintain an efficient system for activating rapid searches and media alerts for a missing senior citizen or disabled vulnerable adult, even when law enforcement agencies have high response demands in other areas. Lots of things going on out there, and we want to make sure we fit into that system in an intelligent and efficient way. 38 other states have established Silver Alerts or similar plans. They don't all use that terminology, but almost everyone has something like this. And those have been done with overwhelming bipartisan support for the way they empower our law enforcement agencies to save lives and money. And despite this, Alaska's just not taken this opportunity to design a dedicated response and notification plan for missing senior citizens, so a policy call is clearly in order. We need this bill to ensure Alaska applies the expertise of these various departments to this plan. This legislation would leave no doubt that a Silver Alert program will be established for Alaska as soon as possible. Given our rapidly growing senior population, some of you have referred to it, like I have, as the Silver Tsunami. We've had a low, relatively low senior population proportionately in the state of Alaska, but it's growing every day. And it's a cause of concern in healthcare, but this is an, and that's a tough conundrum to tackle. But in this regard, it's relatively simple what we should do. We've seen what a Silver Alert program can do in other states, and I'll just give you, there are many, many examples, but I'll just give you one in the interest of time. Just in this past August, Mississippi Highway Patrol publicly praised their Silver Alert program for helping them save three lives in just a single month. An Alaska Silver Alert program would pose no additional cost to the state, thus the zero fiscal note, but it would be invaluable for cutting response times, we believe, when adults with dementia or disabilities who go missing in Alaska's harsh winters or vast wilderness, and could even save local law enforcement's time and money with shorter searches. We've been happy to work with, and I've been asked this, did you work with the broadcasters? Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. The Alaska Broadcasters Association have given their comments, and we've worked with public safety agencies as well. We expect this will be a boost to local law enforcement, and while media participation is voluntary, we expect virtually all media outlets would be happy to help broadcast a missing vulnerable adult report that has been thoroughly but promptly vetted by law enforcement. They don't want to be part of a system that clogs the system or puts alerts out that have not been vetted by law enforcement. So that was an important, not a compromise, but that was an important thing that they told us that went into the drafting of this bill. So in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, we know that when a vulnerable adult goes missing, their best chance of being found alive is if they are found within 24 to 48 hours. I know from the interior we have some sad cases, a woman with dementia driving off and losing her life because of a lack of a system like this. These searches can cost the taxpayers up to, the U.S. taxpayers through federal agencies, up to $1,500 per hour. I'll summarize and just say, Mr. Chairman, we stand ready to explain the differences between the last committee substitute and what is proposed here. And I know we've asked, there are tons of people who wanted to testify. We've asked them to limit themselves to a very short period of time, and there's just two or three of them that are representative of large organizations, okay, if you so choose.
Yes, thank you very much. And we do have a CS before us, and so Senator McGuire, would you just make a motion to get that before us?
You bet. Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the CS for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill number 36 /C for purposes of discussion.
So there are no objection. We'll have this this version before us, CS response to substitute. And I think it has mostly to do with definitions. Am I correct, Senator?
Yes, sir. It's the definition of vulnerable adult. As some of you will remember, we all voted for an more expansive definition under one of the governor's bills last year for vulnerable adults to include some of the other folks that are victims of sex trafficking and other bad things. And law enforcement expressed some concerns, not with that overall, but in the context of this legislation.
Right.
And if it's okay, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nathan Zinsse has been helping me with the details.
Sure.
If you want a brief explanation.
If you wouldn't mind, please, just identify yourself and give us that explanation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan Zinsse, staff to Senator Ellis. In consultation with public safety, I don't know if Lieutenant Rodney Dial is here, but this is a concern he presented. They wanted to return to the old definition of vulnerable adult just for the purposes of this legislation. That definition would be vulnerable adult means a person 18 years of age or older who, because of physical or mental impairment, is unable to meet the person's own needs or seek help without assistance. That's the definition we're proposing. Public safety would like to return to that, so they would never, if I understand correctly, and I do not want to speak for them too much, but so they would never be at risk for having to issue an alert in a domestic abuse case where someone might be trying to abuse a Silver Alert. They also had some concerns with maybe them being too frequent if we were to use the old definition. But in this case, we find returning to the old definition is certainly appropriate. The advocates we've spoken to are fine with it and think it is strong. And in this case, I think it's an example of good cooperation between both affected parties here.
Yeah, really, it seemed to me like, if I remember correctly, it was such a broad definition that they would have had solar alerts going out, which would have made them less and less effective. People would have quit listening to them. So this narrows it down to those who really, whether they're a youngster who's mentally impaired or somebody who's older in dementia, then you really would have somebody on the lookout for them. That's what I understand. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And through the chair, Senator Ellis and Mr. Zinsi, was there any thought to saying vulnerable senior?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, the original version of this bill did say vulnerable adult, and while vulnerable senior would certainly account for a great proportion of these alerts, we also felt in consultation with advocates for Alaskans with developmental or cognitive disabilities that this was an important definition to have to include them, because those are vulnerable folks who are vulnerable as soon as they go missing.
And veterans with PTSD. Right. That was something that came to us a little late, but we thought, and the previous committee thought, that people with PTSD, that category of veterans, should be considered vulnerable adults.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. Senator Dyson?
Yeah. I don't want to get off point very much, but in your research, are other states with similar programs using any electronic tracking devices?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I can certainly look into that.
Don't.
Okay. More.
That's fine. I see some enthusiastic nods in the background there. So, all right. Thank you.
We do have. I think we do have Rodney Dial online. If there's any further questions for Mr. Dial, are you on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Thank you for joining us today. Senator McGuire has a question.
So thank you, through the chair. So, and I guess it's for all three of you then, regarding the vulnerable adult definition. I understand the concern about expanding it to be too far, but then I like the fact that you're considering those with intellectual disabilities, PTSD. I'm hoping the traumatic brain injured are in, I guess. So maybe this is for the bill's sponsor more than Lieutenant Dial. Who then is covered by this definition? And I guess then for Lieutenant Dial, is it a manageable amount of people who are covered?
Mr. Chairman, to
Senator Ellis.
Through the chair to Senator McGuire, as Mr. Zinsi said, we started off, or I'm saying, we started off the legislation with just saying vulnerable adults, like other jurisdictions have done. And in discussing with public safety, well, with the broadcasters and public safety, wanted to limit the definition from what we had more broadly adopted in the context of the governor's crime bill, anti-trafficking bill last year. Then we had the advocates from the developmentally disabled. So basically, we're talking about seniors with dementia and cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's and other dementia. That was the starting point. And the bill also covers vulnerable adults that are developmentally disabled. So that's the, you said the words intellectually, and there's different phraseology here, but it's cognitive impairment, basically, not of the developmentally disabled. And then we also were approached by veterans groups to cover people that have cognitive impairment through PTSD, which is a legitimate diagnosis through the VA and the federal agencies. And so those are the three main categories of coverage. Now, we were very, you know, I'm a person who would like to cover and help as many people as possible. We all have an impulse to help people, but we wanted to be very clear-eyed about this and have our bill comport with the desires of the broadcasters, who are good people but don't want to have the system constantly clogged with every person that is for a moment thought to be missing.
Yes.
And to deal with the demands on public safety,
yeah,
on the law enforcement folks. So I think I hope we've struck a good balance here to get, and to Senator Dyson, you know, we approach this from a broadcast emergency alert system approach rather than an individual tracking component, which some agencies, adult daycare centers and others, are equipping their members. We may hear testimony to that or somewhere along the way. to deal with individuals, but this is more of a system of alert as opposed to an individual tracking. But those are the three main categories of kinds of people that we wanted to cover, because we can't cover everybody. There was a concern, I'll just be very upfront, I've been concerned about chronic public inebriation, out of control addictions, and there are people that choose to drink themselves to death in the woods, and we don't know where they are. It's difficult to deal with them. I've been very compassionate, and we all have together put money into detox and treatment services, but the last thing the law enforcement people wanted to be held liable for and responsible for was tracking people that don't want to be found.
Yeah.
These, we are dealing here with people that have dementia.
Yeah.
And Alzheimer's, and they aren't hiding from us. They have just wandered off, lost their way, and so that's the balance we're trying to strike. I'd like to help everybody. I know we all would, but we can't, with this system, solve all problems.
And just for what it's worth, I do have Joanne Gibbons here with the Department of Health and Social Services, Senior Disability Services, who is here for questions. But it sounds like we kind of got to the root of that question. So,
excellent. Thank you.
It was excellent. Excellent question.
All right. Well, I do have some people to testify, and why don't we go ahead and take that public testimony at this point. I'm not too sure I can pronounce this correctly, but it's Daria. Oh,
Danielle.
It's Denise Daniela.
Okay, my apologies.
My apologies too.
I should have known that as soon as I started reading it, but. Please put yourself on the record, since I butchered it, and then give us your testimony.
Great. Thank you. Senator Coghill, good afternoon, everyone. For the record, my name is Denise Daniello, and I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Aging. And our commission is a governor-appointed commission under the Department of Health and Social Services, charged by statute to plan services for seniors, educate Alaskans about senior issues, and to provide recommendations to the governor and the legislature regarding regulations, legislation, and appropriations for programs serving older Alaskans. So today, on behalf of the commission, I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 36 to establish a missing adult response plan. And although this legislation addresses the needs of people with intellectual developmental disabilities and brain injury, we're going to speak for people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. So wandering, as you probably know, is a common symptom for people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and oftentimes a person with dementia can become lost and disoriented even in their own neighborhood. According to statistics from the National Alzheimer's Association, about 60% of people with Alzheimer's disease may suffer from wandering during some course of the disease. And so for older people in Alaska living in areas with heavy motorized traffic, in areas with with moose or bear around, getting lost can have life and death consequences. And so we are very concerned about protecting those individuals. Here are some sobering statistics. We have about 6,140 Alaskans with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, people age 65 and older. And that population, because of the growth of the senior population in Alaska, is projected to almost triple over the next 20 years. We have about 1 in 9 older Alaskans who may have dementia, and about 1 in 2 people age 85 and older may also have Alzheimer's disease. And recently I read, actually this morning, according to the 2013 Alzheimer's disease report, about 1 in 3 elders will die with dementia symptoms. So we're very concerned about the needs of people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and we have engaged in doing a number of community forums around the state to learn about these needs and also about the needs of family caregivers. So we conducted 7 community forums about Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and one of the top concerns people identified was the need to improve public safety, especially for people with Alzheimer's disease who may wander. And they talked about doing this through a silver alert or community response system. So we're here to, again, support this legislation because we feel that it'll promote greater awareness among law enforcement officials about the needs of people with dementia, as well as to increase community awareness and provide some practical tools that public safety can use in finding people with dementia who may wander, such as using radio, television, and social network messaging that I think are identified in the bill. So I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Is there any questions?
Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
So just out of curiosity, at this point, without this, what is the way people communicate right now? If you have somebody that is in an assisted living home or another agency or support group, they become missing, what is the alert system now?
I'm not sure that there is, and probably Rodney Dial can answer this better than I can, but the way I understand it is that there isn't a formalized plan in place to respond to somebody when they're missing, and that it's kind of a hit and miss, fragmented type. I think we have a missing persons report, but this would provide a more focused attention on the needs of people with dementia, and then some practical tools to help the community respond to that.
Sure. It probably was an unfair question to you, and maybe I should have Mr. Dial speak to that. Mr. Dial, can you hear us okay?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with the troopers out of Ketchikan. I did want to say a few things. The department is supportive of the changes in the CS. And to answer our previous question, we do believe that this is manageable and that it would not be such a great a number to discourage media participation or desensitize the public to the alerts and then reduce the effectiveness of the legislation. What we do currently is the department maintains emergency and media contact lists and plans at all trooper posts that can be utilized in all missing person cases. So we'll use that for pretty much anybody that we have missing that we feel that would be appropriate to go ahead and solicit media participation for. And we do commonly work with the media on cases involving even wanted or dangerous people as well. So we do have that format in place. This legislation could be of benefit to municipalities or smaller departments that might not have a plan in place.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you working with us and on the committee and giving us that advice, and thank you very much. I think Marie Darlin also wants to give some testimony this morning, so Marie, why don't you come on up? And if anybody's here from for HB 24, you might want to alert the prime sponsor. Marie.
My name is Marie Darlin. And I'm here representing AARP, and you will also have in your folder a letter from the AARP state office in which we're using some examples of what happens if you don't have a system whereby everybody who needs to know would be alerted if there were somebody missing. You know, and thinking back to your question, Senator Coghill, about what do we have now, I think the best thing you have right now is if, particularly if it was in a neighborhood, is call the neighbors. And that has been done, we know, in trying to locate somebody who is maybe missing from home, but they figure they're not going to go too far. And if you alert the neighbors, they will watch or look for them. But this is going to be a means then by which everybody who needs to know would be advised. And certainly we know there's been several instances of very unhappy circumstances up north, which this would hopefully alleviate those kinds of things happening. But we know this has worked with Amber Alert for children, so why shouldn't it work for seniors or vulnerable adults? Actually, it's just adults is what we're looking at in this. And for whatever reason that they may be not even realizing they're lost. And so we do support this legislation.
Thank you, Marie.
And thank you.
Somebody said, all of us are going to have to deal with this in 20 years, and I'm looking at the table here, and I see at least two silver-haired guys. I'm the younger one, there's no doubt about it, but in 20 years, I'm going to be right up there.
Thank you.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah. And we will welcome you to the Geezer Caucus.
Thank you, Marie. Thank you very much. I do have one other person that called in, Michael Van Fleet. Is it Vliet, student of social work? Are you online? Can you hear us, Michael?
Hi, my name is Michael Van Fleet.
Go ahead and give us your testimony, Michael.
Excuse me?
Go ahead and give us your testimony. Thank you.
All right, my name is Michael Van Fleet. I'm currently a senior at the University of Alaska Anchorage studying social work. And in social work, your senior year, you have to do an internship. I am doing mine at the Soldier Family Assistance Center on Bay Bear at the Warrior Transition Battalion. And at my agency, we work with the soldiers or service members who are injured in combat and are getting medically discharged for the military. So I'm kind of coming from the veteran and military side for this bill, because as been mentioned before, there is a high number of individuals with traumatic brain injury in our community from the military. And we've had cases on base of soldiers who are just driving to work and call people because they don't remember where they're going or where they're at, or simply show up a couple hours later because they forgot where they're going because they had multiple injuries in combat from traumatic brain injuries. So this bill would also greatly impact the veteran community and the actual active duty military community for those individuals with traumatic brain injury.
Wonderful.
So that's kind of where I'm calling in, to make sure everyone remembers that so many people think about this from the side of elderly adults. There's a lot of people who are between 18 and 24 years old out there who have severe cognitive impairment to the point where they need somebody to assist them where they're going, and when they get out of the military, they might not have that assistance later, and they do end up wandering off and not knowing where they're at because of those injuries.
So,
and that is my testimony.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate, and thank you for being a student in that area. You know, I think that's excellent. And I personally hadn't really thought about the angle of those who temporarily may lose track of where they're at. That's another interesting thought. I greatly appreciate that. Any questions for Michael?
Where is he again?
Michael, once again, are you in Anchorage?
Yes, I am. I'm actually also a disabled veteran. I was in the Marine Corps for 4 years, and I did a couple tours of Iraq, so I have a very personal view of this, and I've seen many individuals that this would apply to.
A student at UAA?
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you for your service to our country, and thank you for taking on this field of endeavor. I think for
and
us.
Thank you for your consideration of my testimony and your time.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Ellis, this is a little different than the original bill. Is there any explanations that you care to bring to our attention at this point? It's just a little more directive than the original bill, but it actually sets it up in motion. So I think that's the, unless you're have any other comment on it. What I'd like to do is let it sit on the table till Friday. My intention is to take action on it Friday. But I want you to kind of look it over and see if there's anything that you want to add or subtract, or if there's something we need to understand better. But I'm satisfied that we have a pretty good bill here. So what I'll do is I'll lay this aside at this point. I'm not going to close public testimony in case you have some other testimony you need to bring, Senator. But at this point, my intention is to bring it up for action on Friday. All right? That will bring us to our next bill, House Bill 24, which is Representative Newman bringing up an act relating to self-defense in any place where a person has a right to be. Please come on forward here, and thank you for being so responsive. It's a little earlier than I thought, which is good because this is probably no light-duty bill. But it's not one that is a stranger to us in the legislature either. So identify yourself and introduce the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Newman. I represent House District 10 in the beautiful Susitna River Valley. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for again hearing the committee substitute for House Bill Number 24, Judiciary, which is an act relating to self-defense in any right, any place that a person has a right to be. And kind of in a nutshell, Mr. Chair and members, is the rights that are granted Alaskans in your own home under the Castle Doctrine, which is the right to defend yourself and your family. This would carry those same rights with you anywhere in Alaska where you have a legal right to be. There, we are not making changes to the justification clauses, and so there's been a lot of questions that always surround this bill of what if, you know, and you can name just about any scenario. And we're not going into the justification clauses and trying to make changes there. There was a slight change done in House Judiciary where the word other was placed in between any and place. Because they did not want the courts to look and see that this preceded other sections in the bill where it says it's your home or a place of business, and so that change was made there. But other than that, Mr. Chair, this again just allows Alaskans who are out on the street enjoying their family to be able to protect themselves and their families. Currently, Alaska has in statute a duty to retreat. This would basically remove that. Because right now what we have is a situation where our court systems where, Mr. Chair, if you were out with your family enjoying yourself, fishing or just enjoying Alaska or just walking to the, down the street, if a criminal came up to you and wanted and it was going to assault you or your family and you felt that there was a necessity for using deadly force, and again, we look at the justification clauses that say that you have to feel that you reasonably believe that the use of deadly force is necessary in self-defense, that you have the right to defend yourself and your family. And this is what we're trying to assure Alaskans who are just honest, hardworking Alaskans that they have those rights.
Representative Senator Dyson, I have a question for you.
I understood that you, in order to be justified in using deadly force, you had to be in fear of death or serious bodily harm.
Through the chair, Representative Dyson, yes, in the justification clause in section 1181.335, which you should have in your packet, it does describe that, and to the extent where the person reasonably believes the use of deadly force is necessary against death, serious physical injury, kidnapping, except what is described as custodial interference in the first degree, sexual assault in the first and second degree, and sexual
you
assault of a minor
my question.
Or robbery. So, yes.
I wanted that to be on the record, that this does not exclude the fact that in order to be justified in using deadly force, you have to be in fear of your life or serious physical injury.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We're not just giving people a blanket permission to shoot somebody.
Absolutely.
If they're just being yelled at or you know, something. Thank you.
I think Senator McGuire had a question as well.
I do, and thank you, Senator Dyson, for putting that on the record. Before I ask my question, just to continue on, in sub B of 1181.335, it continues on to say that a person may not use deadly force under the section if the person knows that with complete personal safety and with complete safety as to the others being defended, the person can avoid the necessity of using deadly force by leaving the area of the encounter, except there's no duty to leave the area if the person is on the premises, the person da-da-da. Anyway, so this is all in there, and so nothing in the bill changes that. Has to be death, serious personal and physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault in the first degree, second degree, sexual abuse of a minor, or robbery in any of any degree. And I think that's great. So I appreciate you putting that on the record. My question is, could you explain the change that was made in the other body's judiciary committee to go from in any place where the person has a right to be to in any other place. What the genesis of that amendment was and why it should matter to us here.
Through the chair, Representative or Senator McGuire, there was a sense in the body and through discussion on that that was brought up because in B in Section 1 where it talks about where a person owns or leases if you're on those premises or where you have a, if you're in your home, that the word other in there would make it so that the courts would not look at this as it supersedes. This clearly identifies that you're in an other place than your home or your business, which is already included in statute.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense.
So, and then listening to the debate that you folks had over there, the section that was in the authorizing section of 1181.335, robbery in any degree and robbery in other degrees kind of became one of the main questions. And it sounds to me like it really came down to the robbery was a self-defense question. Can you give us some of the highlights of that debate and how you landed on that? Because it looks to me like it didn't get incorporated as discussed. So help us understand that just a little bit.
Okay, Mr. Chair. There was a discussion on currently in Alaska statutes, you have the right to defend yourself using deadly force with robbery in any degree. There was a proposed amendment that said that you could not have the right to use deadly force if it was robbery in the second degree. The difference between first degree robbery and second degree robbery, as in your books and under 1141.500 and 510, is robbery in the second degree basically is if you, for lack of better terms, without I could read it for you, I guess, but if you got your hands on or if there's a threat to physical injury. If there's not a threat to physical injury, then it's second degree. But second degree and first degree can happen in a split second. And
give me the reference to that again, and I'll look it up.
1141.510.
Okay, thank you.
In robbery in the second degree under A, a person commits the crime of robbery in the second degree if, in the course of taking or attempting to take property from the immediate presence and control, the person uses or threatens immediate force and for preventing overcome resistance. And some of the discussions that went on is, what if a kid comes up and steals a balloon or something like that? The reason that I did not support that is because, again, to use deadly force, as in the bill where it's in current statute, you have to reasonably believe that it's justified, you know, and I don't think any court would say that any person could feel that they reasonably believe that their life was in imminent danger by just a second degree theft or robbery like that, but it can change in a split second. Right. And there was a lot of discussion when these bills were originally wrote in why they included all robberies in this, and I feel that that's part of that discussion. I wasn't there, Mr. Chair, but obviously, but in respect to legislators who sat in these seats before us as to why they included that provision originally, we respected that.
Well, I wanted to bring it up for discussion here because it was something I grappled with after listening on the floor, but it really comes down to the second degree still requires a taking or attempting to take, which means they're physically putting you in a question. And so I think robbery is somebody kind of taking from you personally. It's not thievery, as in taking something away from your premise or something like that. It really is taking something from you, if I understand correctly.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. And one thing to realize, too, is we're talking about a criminal who is coming up to a law-abiding Alaskan and committing a crime to start with. You know, and to say that, you know, if you reasonably believe and it's that it's justified, you know, because there is a threat on your life, that's why we decided to stay with the original bill.
Just identify yourself.
Rex Shattuck, staff to Representative Newman. On that particular point, when you listen to the original discussions, Representative Newman and yourself are very much on the point, and that point being is robbery is typically against a person. And it's a crime against the person. And so it didn't matter whether it was a balloon or an individual fishing on a boat on a river. If there was some weapon or indication of serious threat, it was against the person, and your deliberations are to protect the rights of an individual.
So it really comes down to, at that point, you are expected that you're going to have a self-defense mode, whereas if you could actually leave with knowing with complete safety, then you're not in a self-defense mode. And that's a fine point that would probably be argued in court, but we want to make sure that the law is very clear to people who are not going to be thinking about fine points of law when they're spending their normal day in their normal activity when somebody interrupts them by some violent act.
Yeah.
And so I just want to make sure that we're seeing the two different sides of that argument.
And Mr. Chair, when we had discussions with this with Ledge Legal, it's the difference. You might have a finger in your pocket, you know, or any indication like that that could be a threat, that could be a gun or a deadly weapon or nunchuck, you know, it could be your fist, it could be a rock. Those were all part of the discussions there, and we spent some time on that and felt that keeping the concurrent statutes was appropriate.
Well, I do have some people online to testify. Rodney Dial is here for questions, so as you guys think about this, Brian Judy is in Sacramento. He's online, so because of the time differences and because of where we're at in the committee, Brian Judy, can you hear us all right?
I can, Senator.
All right. Why don't you just go ahead and put yourself on the record, identify your affiliation, and give us your testimony on this particular bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brian Judy. I'm the Alaska State Liaison for the National Rifle Association, speaking today in support of House Bill 24 on behalf of Alaska NRA members. This is important self-defense legislation that would provide that a law-abiding person who is justified in using deadly force in self-defense has no duty to retreat from an attack if the person is in any place they have a legal right to be. And I just want to reiterate again that it only impacts cases in which a person is actually justified. And I'll just go over that real quickly in a minute, just to reiterate what's been discussed. But let me just say that existing Alaska law already provides that there's no duty to retreat if a person, again, who is justified in using deadly force in self-defense is on premises in which they own or lease, where they reside, in a building where they work. In any other place, however, if they know, the person knows that he or she can safely retreat from encounter, the person is legally required to do so. So in an encounter that necessitates an individual to use deadly force in self-defense, there are two considerations the person must take into account. The primary consideration and the most significant is justification. The secondary consideration, and much less significant, is retreat. And again, the only time retreat becomes a consideration is once the person's made the determination that she's justified in using deadly force in self-defense. It's been discussed, so I'll just cover it really quickly. Justification is provided in the Alaska statutes. And you have to look not only in the section of law that this bill is amending, 1181.335, but you also have to look back to 1181.330. That's the section that deals with non-deadly force. And those two sections build on each other to create the arduous legal requirements that is provided in the Alaska statutes for justification. The bottom line is that a person may only use deadly force in self-defense if the person reasonably believes the use of deadly force is necessary for self-defense against an imminent threat of those circumstances that have been discussed: death, serious physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault, and robbery. Now, it's also important to note that to employ self-defense, a person must satisfy both a subjective and an objective standard. That is, the person must actually believe deadly force is necessary. That's the subjective standard. But the belief of the person must also be one that a reasonable person would have held under the circumstances. That's the objective standard. So it's just not that, you know, this person arbitrarily, you know, wants to shoot somebody. The opposition is really trying to mischaracterize this bill, and it's just not the case. It's a very arduous requirement that lays out what constitutes a justification. It's also important to note that in this framework, there are certain things that are laid out that specifically do not justify a person in using deadly force or non-deadly force for that matter. And that is if a person was engaged in mutual combat, if a person provoked the other's conduct, if the person using self-defense was the initial aggressor, or if the person was involved in felonious or gang activity. In all these circumstances, if that's the case, then you are specifically not justified in using deadly force. And then if you're not justified in using deadly force, then the whole issue of retreat does not even come into play. So again, a person using deadly force in self-defense must have justification and must consider that question in the split second the person has to decide whether to respond to an aggressor with force. So removing the additional question as to whether or not the person can retreat with complete safety essentially provides for one less thing a potential victim must concern herself with in the life or death split-second decision-making process. And again, removing the duty to retreat does not in any way change the fact that a person must be justified. And again, it's only limited to places where the person is lawfully present. Real quick, just a couple, I want to respond to a couple of the arguments that have come up along the way in the process. First of all, opponents have said that this bill promotes violence and will encourage unnecessary violence. We believe that's absolutely false. Again, the basic principle remains that a person, in defending themselves and in standing their ground, may only use deadly force when they reasonably believe it's necessary to prevent an imminent threat. I believe that the justification statute is being mischaracterized by the opposition. A no duty to retreat law does not translate to justification for the use of deadly force when the use of deadly force is not warranted. The other side has said that, you know, they made the claim that, well, heck, a person's only required to retreat if the person knows that he or she can do so with complete safety. That's true. However, a person who meets the arduous legal requirement for justification because her life is at immediate risk should not have to concern herself with the additional question of retreat. Essentially, under the existing law, a person who resists an aggressor bears the risk of a finding that although the response was proportional to the reasonably perceived threat, the person overestimated the difficulty of getting away unscathed and is now therefore guilty of a crime despite the fact that they were justified to react with defensive force. So removing the retreat provision shifts some of the risk calculation back to the aggressor, in our view. The last point I'll make, or the last point of the opposition that I'll address, it's been claimed that this bill will benefit dangerous, violent criminals. And that's just absolutely false. The people who this bill will benefit are people who are justified in using deadly force. And again, let's think about who the duty to retreat really does benefit. It protects persons against whom defensive force would otherwise be justified. So it's the dangerous violent criminals that will benefit if this law is not in place. So in summary, let me just say that the victims should have the protection of law, not criminals. Law-abiding citizens should not fear criminal prosecution when they stand their ground and defend themselves without retreating, when they're justified, and when they're in a place they have a legal right to be. I'll be happy to be available for questions, but on behalf of NRA members, I urge your support for House Bill 24. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Judy. Is there any questions at this point for Mr. Judy? Thank you very much. That was very thorough testimony. Also, we have Quinlan Seiner here, who is open for questions. I don't know that he had any testimony at this point. This bill has actually been through here a couple of times. I think the answer to one of the questions that I heard was that, you know, gunplay between competing
getting bigger.
Yeah, just different groups that might call themselves, you know, some kind of a group. But that falls under the justification, you know, the, you know, mutual combat, provoking conduct. So I think that satisfied me on that one. Any other questions for the sponsor at this point?
Just a comment, Mr. President.
Senator Dyson.
It's instructive to read all the other sections here on self-defense. And the 340 and 350 are interesting. And I remembered, and I was glad to refresh myself here in the last couple of years, we added about carjacking. And that's in the 350 section. And I, on the spur of the moment, put in the definition of what a vehicle is, also an airplane and a boat. Because we all know here in Alaska, somebody taking your car when you're out on a remote highway could be a life-threatening event, and the same with an airplane or a boat. But anyways, the other structure in sections here really expand upon other areas where you can use deadly force. And I think that your bill does not, you don't have to address those other sections. I don't think you're doing anything that affects them after carefully reading it. Let the record reflect, the bill sponsor nodded yes.
Any comment on that, Representative Newman?
Through the chair, Representative Dyson, I agree. Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative?
We do have a letter from the former judiciary chair. Had some questions on a prosecutor from Anchorage who testified, and if we could pass this out to members. And again, this says House Bill 80, which was the former bill. Mm-hmm. The only difference between this bill and that one is the word other was added in there. And I'd like to point out that there's a lot of things that anecdotal evidence or situations that could happen. This eventually will go to a court of law, and they will decide that between the judges and juries. We had extensive testimony in House Finance on from law and others that this wouldn't have much effect on their caseload. Everybody claims they're innocent anyhow, one way or another. But what I would like to point out is that, again, from our Attorney General, who's our chief judicial person in the state, Michael Garrity signed this letter, wrote this letter, and I'd like to just point out, it says, the fact that defendants may attempt to take advantage of the law, what's on the books, should not dissuade us from enacting laws that protect a citizen's right to legitimate self-defense outside his home. I think that really primes up the bill real well, and again, is backed by our chief judicial officer.
So let the record reflect that Senator Wilkowski has joined us. Senator Wilkowski, we're dealing with the House Bill 24, which is the Stand Your Ground self-defense. And what we've done is we've had Brian Judy testify. We've had the sponsor testify. It wasn't my intention necessarily to move this through today, but to bring it up for Friday for action. I haven't heard a whole lot of other dialogue at this point. Is there anything, Senator Dyson?
Yeah, there certainly has been a lively debate in the other body, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about this issue for the last 3 years. I would be very comfortable moving it on. Absolutely your call. And so many folks in this building and out of it have weighed in on it that I...
Right. The only thing I wanted to make sure that we had a dialogue on what conversation happened on the floor in the other body. So That, and that satisfied me. So I'm open to a motion if somebody wants to move it.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for House Bill number 24 /U with individual recommendations out of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Is there any objection to moving CS for House Bill 24? All right. We moved House Bill 24.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
That will bring the committee to an adjournment.